What's the strangest thing you've bought or sold on eBay?
Definitely the dog hair. I tried to sell the dog hair. I didn't sell it, but I listed it.
I didn't expect that answer. How many pounds of dog hair did you try to sell?
You know, I don't know how many pounds it was, but it was 2 black plastic garbage sacks, pretty much full. I lived in a house for 9 months and never swept it. And then when I had to move out, I did it as a joke, but I really did get an email or a message from somebody, I think, in Japan, who's like, more power to you. I don't want to buy it, but that's pretty funny.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Aaron Parrott about his book of stories, Maple and Lead. This conversation contains tales of oddities which may awaken the collector within.
So this book is a collection of 11 stories, including one called 13 Things I've Sold on eBay. And one of the things I really enjoyed about this book, Aaron, is that the term stories felt rather open-ended because there were moments when I couldn't tell if this was nonfiction or fiction. How do you define the word story?
Wow, that's a tough one. It's interesting because I actually write a lot of nonfiction. You know, I was trained in philosophy and comparative literature. And one of the questions you bump up against right away is, what is the difference between actual history and just stories people tell? Because people misremember stuff all the time. So I think it is a tough distinction, especially in this day and age with fake news and alternative facts. But I guess for me, the big distinction is what's called verisimilitude. It's a great Latin word, and it means like the truth. So fiction is supposed to be like the truth, and when it isn't, then we know we're reading something and the illusion is lost. Whereas if it's actually true or completely true, then it would just be, I don't know, memoir or creative nonfiction or something. So I think a lot of these stories are based in actual events, but, you know, you change the details and make stuff up.
That's what I was wondering for you as a writer. When do you know if it's a good story to be told in nonfiction, and when do you need to shift the details?
You know, that's also a tough question because I think a lot of things that happen in real life are too unbelievable to pass as fiction. Like if you pass them off as fiction, people would be like, no way. Whereas things that, again, the verisimilitude part of it, things that you make up a story about, there's an element of truth there that transcends the mundane, actual, everyday, you know, existence that we all have. And I think that's what verisimilitude gets to also.
If I had to pick out an obvious thread that connected many of the stories, there's a male speaker who's being left, cleared out, emptied out, breaking up. There's men sorting out and sorting through their lives.
I wasn't conscious of that at all in writing these, and they were written over a period of 10 years. So a reviewer pointed that fact out, and I was like, oh, wow, that's really true. But, you know, I've been dumped a lot, been through a lot of breakups, and I think, you know, men are quite often just kind of losers. And I'm not exactly sure why that's the case, but I just don't think, as a rule, they have things together.
Is there a narrator in this collection that you most closely identify with?
Let's see. I have to think about that one. You know, at different times I identify with different ones. I'll give you an example. The one that's in the paperback that isn't in the letterpress, the Notebooks of a Philosopher, I wrote sort of making fun of academia, but then I'm an academic, so I don't know.
Will you just then describe the difference between the paperback and the hardcover?
The whole concept of this book came about because I started letterpress printing, and I had this little Chandler and Price 8x12 letterpress machine. You know, it's treadle operated. And a guy walked into the little space where I had it set up, and he just arrived from Colorado, and he said, "Hey, I hear you're a printer and I'm a woodcutter, and you know, we should do something together." And so we, like, that day came up with this idea to print a book, and he would illustrate it, and I would just use these stories that I'd published over the years. And, you know, that required getting another bigger press to do it, because it was a huge ordeal. It took, you know, 8 months of printing 4 hours a day to make 100 copies. It was kind of an absurd labor, but I learned a lot doing it. And then we sewed all the, you know, pieces of paper together, their signatures they're called, and then bound most of them. Some we had bound by a professional binder. And because that was such a labor-intensive process, we picked, I think, 10 stories. And they're, you know, rejected a couple others. And then when we went to make the paperback edition for our friends who couldn't afford $300 a copy for a letterpress book, we added one of those other stories in.
And all the stories in the collection have been published elsewhere, right?
Right.
I want to come back to the letterpress, the art in the letterpress later, but I want to stick with your specific stories. Will you read a section from 13 Things I've Sold on eBay?
You know, literary people will recognize that the title is, I think, a Wallace Stevens poem, or is it Wallace Stevens?
Oh, yeah.
13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird.
Mm-hmm.
And I was selling a lot of stuff on eBay. And when you do that and you start reading about other people who do it, I think what prompted the story was reading about the guy who dressed up in his wife's, he got divorced or something, his wife left him, and he dressed up in her wedding dress. And I mean, it went for like $9,000, but not because the dress was valuable. It was just, he told this great story and there's pictures of him, and it sort of became like performance art.
Right.
And so then I just started thinking about, you know, telling the story of some kind of breakup through things that you would sell on eBay. And this, probably of all the stories, this one is cut the most from whole cloth. Like, very little of this actually happened to me. My wife's ghost. After 2 years, I still couldn't stop thinking about my wife. That's when I decided the house she left me was haunted. If not by her, I was reasonably sure she wasn't dead yet, then by some kindred spirit who was determined to keep me sad and wounded. I found myself down in the basement late one Saturday evening, towing the cracks in the ancient foundation, numb to the fact that I had nothing better to do that weekend than to wander among the cobwebs in the darkest quarter of an empty house. I spied an old ball jar resting on a brick wall behind a floor joist and carried it with me upstairs into the kitchen, where I washed and rinsed it and found a lid for it. I drew a vague face on it with the Sharpie marker and took a picture of it. I listed it under Truly Bizarre as the ghost of my wife, making up a story about how after 17 years of blissful marriage, she was called away to Jesus one afternoon as she sat in the sewing room of our house, dutifully crocheting me a wool vest for my birthday. I sentimentally described our storybook romance and waxed rhapsodic about how she came to visit me as an apparition. The pain was simply too great to bear, I wrote, and as I couldn't afford to sell the house to leave my wife in peace in her home, I had trapped her soul in a jar and was hoping to sell it to someone who believed in the power of life after death and was willing to provide her ghost a loving home. Finally, I had struck pay dirt. The bidding went crazy for 9 days. A week later, a check arrived for $2,137 from a fledgling parapsychologist in Muncie, Indiana, who was collecting ghosts for a research project. I carefully typed up a few pages of memories of my wife so that she would have some behavioral manifestations to watch for, and I closed with a plea for the eager young woman to treat my wife's ghost with dignity and respect by keeping the jar at a relatively constant temperature. 78 degrees Fahrenheit seemed ideal.
There's a line you write in this story. Nevertheless, I have to admit on some level that I was hoping to reconnect by way of what she left behind. I think there are lots of ways we tether ourselves to relationships. What are the speakers in your stories needing to hold on to, and how are they going about doing it?
You know, I hadn't ever really thought about it, but it's true that, you know, people keep things, mementos or talismans or whatever, that, you know, just looking at it or holding it conjures up the past. And I think a really common version of that is like letters from somebody or pictures. And I just think that's a really human experience to, you know, want to preserve your past. Part of it that fascinates me is the artifact part of it. I have collected stuff all my life, but there's a great Simpsons line where I think Lisa says, if you're going to binge, you got to purge. So I'm not a hoarder. Like, I collect stuff and then I get rid of it. And it's just as liberating to like get rid of stuff as it is to collect it, or, you know, they're reciprocal experiences, I guess. So I don't think I'm obsessive like a lot of these people in the story are, but I understand that mentality, you know, I have part of it at least.
Which leads me to Notebooks of a Philosopher. There's a guy, and there's actually no women in this story, but there's a guy who's contemplating his own philosophical worth, and he goes to a drugstore and buys the whole thing out of the notebooks, and then actually ends up needing to return a lot of them. And you write, a bulk purchase had seemed the thing to do in the grip of such earnest conviction. So I wanted to know, Aaron, in the grip of conviction, what have you bought in bulk?
Modern library books. And to me, I guess that gets to the heart of the whole collecting thing. You know, if you're really a true collector, you have to be what they call a completist. Like, you need everything. And I was thinking a lot about that, I guess, when I wrote the story, and also the idea of any kind of obsession, you go overboard. So you don't just go buy a notebook or a composition book. You buy 10 of them. Or you don't just go buy a pen. You have to buy... And I think because that's such a big part of our psychology, we have stores that cater to that now, like Staples, where you buy 50 pens at a time, or Big Lots, where you buy a year's worth of toilet paper at a time. It's absurd. But I think the notebooks part of it was definitely the completest. So yeah, my obsession, I guess the first one to think of was modern library books.
I also want to know where the names come from in your book. There are names like Alvin, Irwin, Evelyn, Elise, Shona, Gerbil Prolix, and Gudger Spaulding.
That story with the Gudger Spaulding character is actually based on a really good friend of mine from the Deep South, and I lived there for 10 years, and a lot of men down there have these really bizarre names. It just occurred to me that somebody I remember, a pretty famous person actually in Athens, was named Finizi Spaulding.
So how do you spell that?
P-H-I-N-I-Z-Y, I think. And a lot of them have, you know, they take family names. So I had a lot of friends with three last names. So that's where that name came from. Gerbil Prolix, I think that's the academic lampoon. Prolix is, you know, means very verbose, and gerbil, you know, sounds like gerbil.
Just spelled differently, right?
Just spelled differently, you know, yeah.
There were other words that stood out to me. One, Gedanken experiment. How do you actually say it, and what does it mean?
Well, you said it pretty accurately. Gedanken experiment is, I mean, how I would say it. I think the general rule is when you take a foreign word, you pronounce it like you would in English. But I think that is the German pronunciation.
And what does it mean?
A thought experiment. So it's not something you would actually try and practice, but, you know, it's a way of thinking about a problem to get you started.
Is this what fiction is?
I think it really is. I mean, that is what it is.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Aaron Parrott about his book of stories, Maple and Lead. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, we'll talk about Aaron's printing press, Territorial Press, as well as Seth Roby's illustrations, which accompany his stories in the book Maple and Lead. This book is accompanied by beautiful illustrations. So you've talked a little bit about your collaboration with Seth Roby, but how did you match up the specific cuts, linoleum and woodcuts, with the stories?
You know, this was a really enlightening process for me. I'd never done anything like this. I'd never, you know, met a woodcutter, wood carver. I'm not even sure what you call it. You know, he cuts in linoleum and wood. I think he even makes engravings in metal too. But I just gave him the manuscript and I said, why don't you read these stories? And if anything strikes your fancy in there, then we'll talk about doing something. And really, like a month later, he came and he said, yeah, I've got illustrations for them all. Like, he works really fast and really liked the stories. And I looked at him and I loved all of them. I mean, I think he really found the motif that worked for each story.
How did you get into the letterpress world?
I was on my way to Berkeley to visit a girlfriend I had at the time who was going to the theological seminary there. And a lot of my friends in Helena said, oh, if you're going to Berkeley, you got to meet Peter Koch. He's a long time, actually kind of a famous personage around Missoula here. He ran the Black Stone Press here in the 70s and put out Montana Gothic. And so I kind of knew who he was. And when I got to Berkeley, I called him on the phone and said, hey, Rick Newby told me I should call you up. And he said, well, where are you? And I gave him the address and he said, oh, you're 2 blocks away. Just keep walking. And spent like the whole day with him. And the minute I walked into his shop, I've told people it was like a harpoon to the amygdala. Mm-hmm. The smell of the ink and the, you know, all that lead type. You know, if you're talking about collecting stuff, I mean, that's the whole package. Millions of little drawers and tiny little pieces of type. And a friend of mine here in Missoula who's a printer jokes about how it's all made from unobtainium because you can't get it anymore.
Does your letterpress have a name, and where did he or she come from?
You mean the machine itself?
Yes.
No, I haven't named it. Maybe I should. But the name of the shop we call the Territorial Press.
Why Territorial?
It so happened that about the time I got into this stuff, I was writing Montana Then and Now and reading a lot about the territorial days and learned that Montana was the last of the states to get the printing press. It was pretty late, 1863, early 1864, after Alaska, after Idaho, you know, literally the last place to get the emblematic symbol of civilization. And the Montana Post was the first newspaper, the first place to get a press. And what I loved about reading those old issues is that it was obvious they were filling space and they would just sit at the typecase and make stuff up, you know, social notices or comments on the new restaurant in town. And it's written in this really fustian kind of style. It's hilarious. And I tried to imitate that in my early broadsides and stuff.
In 2016, you put out a little pocketbook called Curses.
Yeah.
Where you translate some Latin phrases into curses.
Actually, they're not translations.
Right. What do you call it then?
I guess I have to explain the conceit of that book was that I'd gotten this Chandler and Price treadle press and I wanted to make a book, but I knew it had to be small because you can't print very big. I could only print it 4 up. And I didn't want it to be a lot of text because I hand set the type, but I wanted it to be something that, you know, people would like. And it just struck me standing in front of the typecase, you know, this curse, the standard curse went through my head with the F word. And then I thought, oh, we use that word in so many curses. I could just do a little book of curses, which I did, but I didn't think that was enough. And then I was teaching Latin at the time and I thought it would be funny to match them up with some kind of, you know, one phrase or one sentence commentary. So they're not translations. People think they are, but they're actually like a comment about the curse. So the, you know, the standard curse involving the F word that you would say to somebody, the Latin commentary just is the standard greeting that you would say in Latin. Hello, my friend.
I was wondering if there was something particularly gratifying about using the letterpress with a foreign or old language.
It's actually exasperating because, take Spanish, for example, with all the diacritical marks, you know, the tilde and the, I don't know what they call it, accent grave or whatever. French would be the same way. you have to buy special sets of type to make that happen. And if you don't have them, I mean, you can't really do it in a foreign language. I have acquired a few sets of the diacritical letters, but then they might not match the font that you want to use.
About curses, you write, curses served as a kind of crash course in typographical, I'm going to let you pronounce this word,
Aufklärung.
My earnest attempt to explore what Kant called self-imposed immaturity.
Yeah, that whole commentary is sort of a long inside academic joke about what, you know, Kant wrote this famous essay called What is Enlightenment? During the Enlightenment, like when they were starting to talk about what this new age we were entering was. And Kant is kind of famous for obfuscating as much as he explained. And he described enlightenment, Aufklärung, as pulling yourself out of your self-imposed immaturity. I just love that phrase. It's like, and I don't know if he was talking about the Dark Ages, you know, where we repudiated all the accomplishments of the classical era or what, but it really resonated with me that our ignorance is so often self-imposed. Like, I didn't know anything about letterpress.
In tracking back to your collection of stories, I'm thinking about the self-imposed immaturity of your characters.
Yeah, I think it really applies to almost every guy in the book, that there is a certain naivete, or, you know, they behave dumbly, but almost kind of in a proud way, like, or careless, like it doesn't ultimately matter that much.
Another thing that struck me is this sentence that you write, the value of our most meaningful human productions abide in a realm wholly off limits to the wolves of Wall Street. And what do you mean by that, and how does it relate or inform artistic creation?
I think it's a complicated way of saying that poets are born, not paid.
Right.
And the reason I say that is if I calculated, you know, the hourly rate per hour for printing Maple and Lead, you know, I would have lost, I could have done almost anything and made money, but curses definitely took a lot of time, and, you know, my hourly rate probably worked out to 50 cents an hour. So it's not about the money. It couldn't really be about the money, or you wouldn't do it.
What is it about?
The artifact. Ultimately, I think you make an artifact, and even if there's not very many of them, if you've spent any time collecting anything, you realize that there are people who appreciate it, whatever it is.
A bag of dog hair?
Even a bag of dog hair.
How many hours did Curses take, and how many hours did Maple and Lead take?
Curses, I think I figured out, was about 50 hours. Maple and Lead took about a year. So probably half time, maybe 1,000 hours total. A lot of printing time. I think I calculated it was 13,000 trips back and forth on this press that you roll by hand. Because it was, I think, 18 sheets printed, some of them six times for the two colors and then the illustration. And then we had to fold them all and sew them and bind them. It was a ridiculous labor of love.
Did you ever find a typographical error?
I think there is one, but, you know, that wasn't handset type. I have to clarify that. Okay. For that book, that was laid out on a computer, and then we made plates and printed from the plates. So we really, you know, scrutinized. I think there is one or two. I'm not going to point them out, though, so maybe you won't notice them.
On the back of the book, Smith Henderson calls you arguably the best writer the state of Montana has ever produced. I know it's not fair to ask you, but where do you stand on Smith Henderson's claim?
I think it's pretty over the top, but I like that he put the word arguably in there to cover any opposition. I think both of those blurbs on the back are pretty funny, and they're friends of mine. I don't think they're serious.
I think it becomes apparent in the process of both reading the book and just holding the book that it's a labor of love and a labor of brotherhood and sisterhood, maybe. How would you describe the community of this book?
All the different characters in there?
It's just like what it took to produce it, inside and outside.
Definitely the letterpress part of it took a lot of patience from my wife, because it was a lot of time putting it together. I think that's probably true of Seth also. And I think it's just, a really fortuitous intermingling of people. Like, I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't met Peter Koch. You know, what are the odds that a guy would just walk into my shop and say, I want to make a book? And yeah, it was a neat experience in that regard.
So what's the philosopher's take on that type of serendipity?
You know, it's funny about serendipity. I thought for a long time that that word meant when you find something that you were looking for something else and then you found this other thing. But it turns out that that's not quite what it means. It actually refers to a kind of logical process by where you work back from very little data to figure out what happened. So it's really the Sherlock Holmes kind of reasoning. I just wrote an essay where I was talking about this, and I joked that, you know, discovering the true meaning of serendipity was serendipitous for me in the old sense of the word that was wrong.
Right. Does it apply to your situation? I'm just thinking about maybe the circumstances that ultimately unfolded to this production.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by thinking back through those things. You know, I think the only reason I ever started writing any of these stories was I got overwhelmed 7 years of graduate school in literature. And by the end of it, I was like, I bet I could do this.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't take creative writing courses or go the, you know, I'm not an English person. I took like 4 English classes in college. But I think that studying literature like I did, and philosophy, I had a different take on it maybe. So that it wasn't, I don't know what the word is, self-conscious maybe. It was fun. I guess I do things because they strike me as interesting or fun.
What are you working on next, and what is coming out of Territorial Press next?
I'm so glad you asked. We just finished a book called Thumbprints, which worked the opposite way. Seth came to me with 12 miniature little woodcuts and said, would you write text for these? So they're, I don't know if you'd call them prose poems or, but they're just little meditations that I wrote on each one of these tiny little postage stamp sized woodcuts. And we just finished printing that and binding it all up, but they're all sold out. That's one of the problems with letterpress.
Aaron Parrott has a PhD in comparative literature and lives in Helena, Montana, where he runs Territorial Press. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.